dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the things that may determine, literally, the future course of the war for the free world, of course, is the future of America, American democracy, America's government. I've had called to my attention in the past 24 hours a story that may do as much to determine the future shape of America and its democracy as anything I've come across. And the man who brought it to my attention was Greg Phillips. He is the founder of a new organization called Voters Trust. He is working with a woman that I've come to know and admire greatly over the years, Catherine Engelbrecht of the King Street Patriots in Houston, Texas, and also a terrific group called True the Vote. And they have raised an alarm about something called Demos. You can find out more about it at demos.org, and they've particularly raised a warning about a product of this organization funded by George Soros, a new report by Lisa Danetz entitled Building a Healthy Democracy, Registering 68 Million People to Vote Through Health Benefit Exchanges. Greg Phillips, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm very glad to have you and very appreciative of the heads up you've given us all about this. It features at Breitbart.com today. Talk a little bit about this report, what this Demos group is about, and more to the point, what might the impact be of their agenda with respect to the Obamacare program?
Frank, thank you so much for having me. It's such a great pleasure, and thank you so much for all you do for America and freedom. It's such a joy to have an opportunity to visit with you today. Yeah, it's quite ironic that that the building of this report, which talks about the adding of 68 million new voters to the rolls, they somehow characterize and characterize as building freedom in America. In fact, it does just the opposite of that. What they've done is they have been building, Frank, for years, the building blocks of this. They've been laying the foundation, and they've been preparing for this moment, for this place in time where they would have all of the different components, all of the pieces and parts of the Obamacare pieces. They'll have all of the National Voter Registration Act. They'll have innumerable components and contracts in place for navigators, people to actually help them subvert what has been the American voting system now for 200 plus years, and they seem to believe that it's not working for them, so they found a way to try to blow it up, add their people onto the rolls, and that's where we sit now, and it's truly frightening.
Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this, because what you've said certainly concentrates the mind, Greg Phillips. How does it work specifically, this engineering of the Obamacare mechanics for the purpose of voting registration? It seems as though those wouldn't be two items in the same operation under any normal circumstance. What's going on?
Yeah, it's painfully simple. Healthcare.gov, the website that we've heard so much about, the website that's down frequently, that Secretary Sebelius had to speak about. It's been in the news pretty much nonstop for 2 weeks. That's the portal. That's the catalyst. when an individual, an American, comes into that portal, one of the very first things they ask, Frank, is how much money do you make? What is your income? Once you answer that question, then your fate is then either sealed to move into these insurance exchanges where you've heard that people are paying premiums and deductibles and all the typical insurance products. That's just one section of it. But unfortunately, what we know now is that that's about 15% of the people coming to that website. The other 85%, once they say they don't make enough money to participate in the exchanges, they are shuffled directly into another category, which registers them to vote, or, sorry, which registers them for Medicaid, state Medicaid programs. But even worse than that, it also compels them to register to vote.
I'm sorry, you said that compels them to register to
it
vote?
It compels them to register to vote. One of the truisms that we've all dealt with now for the last 20 years, there was something called the National Voter Registration Act, sort of euphemistically known as motor voter. And what we've all known about motor voters, it's very prescriptive, but once you say, I don't want to register to vote, then that's it. You answer the question and you move on. Well, the way this is structured now, rather than opting in to vote and saying, I do want to register to vote, you now have to opt out. You have to say, I don't want to register to vote. Since I saw you yesterday, I've learned an even more troubling development that even if you say no, your information is still going to be transmitted to the states, and the states will then force you to say no yet again. So what they've created is an environment where a double opt-out, meaning say no, I don't want to register, and when somebody asks you again, no, I don't want to register again. How many Americans are actually going to do that? You know, how many people would say no? They're thinking to themselves, certainly, well, they must want me to really register to vote here.
Well, especially as you and Catherine pointed out in the Breitbart.com piece, Greg Phillips, these are people who are looking for free health care, and they presumably feel a certain pressure from the government, at least implied pressure from the government, you know, to get with the program, to participate as they're being told to do. And there is this other element of it, Greg, you alluded to this a moment ago, that has to do with the so-called navigators. And I hadn't really thought about this until you mentioned it and then amplified on your comments of yesterday at a meeting we attended in Breitbart's piece. But these navigators are not government employees, and therefore they are not under the same strictures that government employees are supposed to conform to. Talk a little bit about that. Who are these folks, and what might that mean in terms of what seems to be a rather insidious agenda here of bringing people onto the voter rolls under somewhat coercive techniques, but also with very much a view to making them into Democratic voters, it would seem.
Yeah, I want to be really careful here and say that some of these contractors, and that's what they are, have received grants from the federal government that allow them to employ these new people called navigators. And what they are supposed to be helping you navigate, or they're supposed to help America navigate, is this very complex healthcare exchange set of websites and forms and all sorts of things. So the navigators live in the communities. They are true community organizers, and they have been bought and paid for to do exactly what we're talking about here. Not only register you to enroll in Medicaid, but register you to vote. So many of these people, and it's not as much the actual contracts that we worry about. Some of them are probably legit, good community organizations that are doing, you know, great work in their communities. What we worry most about are the subcontractors. We have found that there are $10,000 contracts, $25,000 contracts that are subcontracts to the main big overall contract. We have no idea who these people are. We have a suspicion. We have some evidence, and it's been reported that the lady that used to run Acorn in the South is now in charge of some of these navigators. We have rumored that the OFA has placed their people there.
Organizing for America, the Obama machine, campaign
absolutely.
Machine.
Absolutely.
Greg Phillips, this is a subject that we've only begun to scratch the surface, I think. It has such significance for national policy, including national security policy, if what we really find is we've manufactured through this Obamacare business a new electoral majority, a permanent electoral majority for people who are interested in entitlements but not necessarily interested in the common weal, shall we say. I thank you for calling this to our attention. Greg Phillips of Voters Trust, the great work you and Catherine Engelbrecht are doing is deeply appreciated. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. If you would, we'll talk with Diana West next, get her take on this story and much more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by our friend and colleague Diana West, syndicated columnist, a regular featured guest of this program, and the author of a simply sensational new book entitled American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. And Diana, I want to talk a little bit about that book and some of its principal observations and conclusions in a moment. But first, I wanted just to get a reaction from you to the kind of information that Greg Phillips has just presented about the apparent use of Obamacare's web registration and so on as a vehicle for really, in effect, compelling people, particularly people who may fit a certain demographic, to register to vote, which sets up, presumably, them as targets for the sort of Obama-style electoral machine, campaign machine particularly. Talk a little bit about that as an issue, if you would, and where you come down on it.
I find the revelation staggering, and yet it's staggering in the way of, you know, blasting through bedrock and finally seeing the other side. I think that we have long suspected that Obamacare, socializing medicine, was a technique of control more than any concern for the amount of Americans who are not insured or getting us better health care. It has never seemed to be that way. I've always, and many conservatives have always looked on it as a means of controlling life from birth to grave in a very intimate way, a very totalitarian way. With this voter registration aspect, you start to realize why perhaps nobody's breaking into a sweat at the complete chaos we've been witnessing. Maybe the chaos is actually a distraction, because as we're finding out, voters, healthcare customers / voters are registering. We're looking at hundreds of thousands of new voters already. And
many more will be obliged to do it shortly. We're speaking with Diana West about, among other things, this, well, sort of seemingly compulsory voter registration aspect to the whole Obamacare program, as laid out in a very interesting conversation we've concluded in the previous segment with Greg Phillips. And Diana, you were talking a bit about this is kind of part of a larger agenda of control, and that we might be kind of having our attention to that and its ominous implications deflected by the Obamacare debacle and, you know, the Secretary of Health and Human Services being flayed on Capitol Hill for some of it, but missing this other, perhaps even ulterior motive. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I am. And I think there's an important piece of it that needs to be underscored. This is something that Betsy McCoy has written about in the last months. The job, the very important job of actually enrolling the uninsured in these health plans, has been outsourced from the government and entrusted to community organizations. Now, this is really, really important, because by doing this, and this I think is where you can look at nefariousness as a motivation, you are eliminating the accountability, the necessity for government employees to be nonpartisan when they are on the job. You are allowing community activists to do things that government employees cannot do, which is something Betsy McCoy pointed out. And this would include urging people to register as Democrats. So it's a very important piece of it that I think really makes it all come home, when you realize that you actually have to, you know, do something extra to opt out when you are actually doing your health insurance enrollment, and that you are having a community organizer, somebody who has been picked, as we also know, from the healthcare plan, from also Betsy McCoy's reporting on it. She's been doing a wonderful job, that these people are chosen for race and ethnicity matching their local community, not, for example, expertise in insurance and things like that. You are looking at a real vote. Motor voter to the max scheme. And I think that this becomes on steroids. Scary.
We should assign a name to this. Of course, one of them in this community organizing business is either under its own auspices or under sort of new guises, ACORN. An organization that has a very disreputable record and yet has been associated with President Obama for many years, and he with it. And it seems to be getting a new lease on life, an infusion of taxpayer funds, as you say, all kinds of opportunities for mischief-making, Diana West. And it's really quite staggering what the implications might be.
Well, the implications are, yes, a permanent majority. I mean, we looked at the last election between Mitt Romney and President Obama, and candidate Romney lost by, what, about 5 million votes. So once you're adding a million here, a million there of reliably Democratic voters who will continue to vote for their benefits, because that is essentially the guise on which they are being enrolled in the first place or signed up on the voter rolls in the first place, you are looking at a permanent Democratic majority, which I think really has been the end goal of the whole socialization of this country that has been going on since the days of FDR, who was a master at understanding the importance of pitting class on class and minority group as political wedges and so on. So this really is almost the culmination of 8 decades.
That's where I wanted to go with you next, Diana West. Again, as our guest, she's our nationally syndicated columnist and the author of two splendid books, The Death of the Grown-Up and more recently, American Betrayal. And in fact, American Betrayal was very highly acclaimed in a program that I attended night before last, Diana, at the Westminster Institute. An old colleague by the name of Ken DeGraffenried, a specialist in information operations and specifically how totalitarians, whether it's the communists of yesteryear or the Islamists of today, are using them against free societies, including ours, to considerable effect. And one of the things that Ken said, in addition to praising to the heavens, appropriately, I think, your book, American Betrayal, was the kind of documentation that you've done as to how the socialists managed to penetrate the FDR administration and, in fact, have enormous sway over its policies under the New Deal and, you know, subsequent conduct of the war and World War II vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and so on, really was not simply an act of successful denial and deception on the part of the socialists or the communists, if you will, or even self-denial on the part of those in the U.S. government. But it was a matter of some agents of theirs actually perpetrating the big lie against the rest of us. Talk a little bit about that, Diana, and how that might be playing out today as well.
I'm delighted to hear that, Frank, by the way. Thank you for telling me. The big lie has been with us, again, really institutionalized since the days of FDR, and I do date it back to what we're actually coming up on the 80-year anniversary of recognition of the Soviet Union. We were recognizing the Soviet Union based on an exchange of notes that essentially consisted of promises by the Soviet Union not to try to subvert our Constitution. Well, this was underway at the time, and of course only ramped up with this recognition, with the absolute just onslaught of these agents, assets, sympathizers of the communist way into the Roosevelt administration. And it required the administration to continue lying about the absence of any problem in order to preserve this alliance. And here is where I think we see parallels with our own post 9/11 situation. We tell big lies in the same way to preserve alliance rather than protecting our national security. And this will entail lying about the nature of the Muslim Brotherhood, or just being completely subverted to the point of not understanding, perhaps, as we see with, you know, Director of National Intelligence Clapper telling Congress it was infamously a largely secular operation.
So much more to cover on this topic, Diana, and I look forward to doing so again with you next week. I'm afraid we are hard out of time for now, but thank you for stitching these dots together for us, as you do so well. Keep it up in your column and in your conversations here and elsewhere, and we'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz, who takes us inside the ring to find out what, among other things, the Soviet Union redux is starting to look like. The Kremlin under Vladimir Putin. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Nearly 5 years into the Obama presidency, it's no longer possible to avoid a stunning reality. The world is a far more dangerous place for the United States and its vital interests than it was when Barack Obama came to office. Worse yet, our capacity to deal with such dangers has been greatly diminished. Perhaps most alarming is the degree to which these realities are being obscured by the president and his subordinates. It amounts to national security fraud. Take, for example, Team Obama's insistence that it has reset relations with Russia. In fact, the only things that are actually being reset are the Kremlin's offensive nuclear and conventional forces capabilities and the pension for threatening others that they make possible. End the fraud, Mr. President, and reset our security. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz. He's the guy who takes us inside the ring. That is, of course, the title of his prize-winning column at the Washington Times. He's also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon and a regular featured guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us, Bill. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be on the program.
Let's cover some of the things you've been reporting on, Bill, that are of great moment. One is that despite much talk about a reset with Russia, it sure looks like what Vladimir Putin is doing is resetting Russia's military capabilities, both nuclear and conventional. Talk a little bit about some of the exercises that have been going on and what we've learned about capabilities that the Russians are now bringing to bear as a result.
Yes, on Wednesday, Russian strategic nuclear forces conducted what was reported to be a snap nuclear exercise that involved the test firing of four long-range missiles. This was led supposedly by Vladimir Putin himself in the role as commander-in-chief. Obviously, the Russians are picking up on the U.S. model for nuclear control. And this was a large-scale exercise on short notice that clearly shows that the Russians are moving ahead with their a major buildup of their strategic nuclear forces. They fired off an SS-18 ICBM, that's their biggest land-based missile, an SS-25, which they call the Topol, which is a road-mobile ICBM, very difficult to find. And then in addition to that, they fired two submarine launch missiles identified by U.S. intelligence as an SSN-18 and an SSN-23. They are carried on Delta III and Delta IV missile submarines. So this was a significant exercise. They also tested missile defenses. They also tested some short-range dual-use nuclear and conventional weapons, including the SS-26, which the Russians have threatened to put in basically the European theater in response to U.S. missile defenses. So, again, there's a lot of saber-rattling going on here. And this comes as the U.S. has been engaged in some fairly feckless missile defense talks with the Russians.
Well, and indeed, more generally, a fecklessness about this whole idea that actually relations with the Russians is are improving and will continue to do so if only we continue to try to accommodate them. Bill, there's, by contrast, very little evidence that the United States is serious about modernizing its nuclear forces. There was a hearing this week in the House Armed Services Committee, and there's some upgrading of old, very old bombs and warheads, but no modernization in the true sense of the word. Talk a little bit about the contrast between the Russian programs and the U.S.
Yes, we had senior defense and energy department officials, including Robert Keller, General Keller, who is the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, appeared before the House Armed Services Subcommittee on Strategic Forces to explain to Congress the need for a very costly but urgently needed upgrade of really one of the oldest nuclear bombs in the U.S. arsenal, a system called the B-61. This is a very important program. Democrats are attacking it. They don't want to spend the estimated $11 billion that will be spent over the next 10 years to upgrade this weapon. But this is really the only dual tactical and strategic nuclear bomb in the arsenal. In other words, it's carried by the B-2 bomber, and it also will be used on conventional aircraft. Right now, the F-16 and the future F-35. So this is an important program. And as I said, Republicans are promoting it. General Keller and the Pentagon say we urgently need this. And yet Democrats challenged them on this and said, well, if we have to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons, as President Obama has urged, then why do we need this particular bomb?
Right. And was there a good answer to the question?
Yes. They explained that the alternative is another gravity bomb called the B-83, which is a megaton class that is in the equivalent of the millions of tons of TNT, whereas the B-61 has a varying yield. And yet is so we need that varying yield, the lower end of the yield, to be able to use it for our allies. If we don't modernize this weapon, there's a good chance that states in Asia will have to rethink U.S. what they call extended deterrence. That is the extension of our nuclear umbrella to allies in Asia, Japan and Korea and Europe as well.
Yeah, I would guess Europe as well. And again, this is not a modernization of the core of the bomb itself, which is, 30, 40, 50 years old. I don't know. It goes back quite a ways.
60, yes.
Yeah, but it certainly is a case that it's got some improvements that could be made to its packaging and its precision delivery capabilities. But it is stunning to me, Bill Gertz, that we're listening to people say, we've got to refrain from engaging in any kind of upgrading of our nuclear forces because we're going to be getting rid of all of them. This is simply crazy and irresponsible, especially, as you've said, Bill, against the backdrop of what's happening elsewhere around the world with nuclear powers like Russia and, for that matter, China. Let me turn, Bill, quickly to another topic that I know you've been following closely. The National Security Agency has come in for some significant criticism, not just from the usual suspects, but it would appear even from President Obama, who claimed that he was unaware of some of its capabilities and activities. What's going on there, Bill? It seems as though the intelligence community said that ain't so. But what's your sense of the ground truth?
Well, right now we're witnessing kind of a feeding frenzy of anti-intelligence sentiment as a result of the Snowden disclosures. And unfortunately, the president does not seem to be backing the National Security Agency, which is far and away the premier intelligence gathering organization in the U.S. government. And this week, the top officials appeared before a House Intelligence Committee hearing, and General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, made an impassioned appeal. Don't restrict our capabilities. He pointed out that last year was the deadliest year for terrorism, with something like 15,000 people killed just in the last month alone. 1,300 were killed in mostly Southwest Asia. And he pointed out that there hasn't been a single terrorist attack, mass terrorist attack in the U.S., and he said that's not by accident. It's a result of being able to go after these terrorists. And yet it appears that the Obama administration, with the backing of the president, are getting ready to restrict further U.S. Electronic intelligence gathering. It's a dire situation because, like I say, our human capability and our military intelligence capabilities are good, but they don't even come close to what the NSA is capable of doing in terms of being able to identify and then helping to stop terrorists.
Yeah, and I'm afraid, Bill, that what's in prospect for the NSA has also been happening to the other military and CIA capabilities as well, and to varying degrees. And it seems to me it's a parallel to the kind of wrecking operation that's been going on vis-a-vis the United States military, what's happening in the intelligence community as well. And Bill, lastly, let me just ask you a little bit about something. We did a paper this past week by my colleague Ben Lerner about unmanned, remotely commanded vehicles of one kind or another, particularly what are often called drones, unmanned aerial vehicles. It seems as though from your reporting in the Washington Times Inside the Ring column last week that China is making a major effort to include both offensive and defensive drones in their arsenal. The implications of that, very quickly?
Yeah, this is a major strategic issue. The issue of drones, and the Chinese are going aggressively in developing armed drones. They're bragging about it. They have one particular drone called the Rainbow, which recently was used to surveil over the Senkaku Islands. The trajectory there for the Senkakus and the Chinese use of drones is not a good direction. I mean, the U.S. kind of led the way with drone technology. We've been doing it for 10 years now, and there's a great proliferation of this. And it's certainly, in the case of China, it's something that needs to be watched very carefully. In fact, one article quoted in the Chinese military press as claiming that China had actually shot down some high-altitude drones. I don't believe that to be true, but nevertheless, they're making some.
They're working on it, for sure. Bill Gertz, we've got to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us, as always, and for the great work you do at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Ambassador Frank Rooney about his time at the Holy See and the role of the Vatican in today's world as well. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around.
And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Michael Medved says stupidity in our federal government is a bipartisan issue.
This administration and the leadership of Barack Obama
and the leadership of some folks in the Republican Party
are both so stupid and just so inane and brain dead. Can you see some kind of bright side here?
Stupid is, stupid does, sir.
The Michael Medved Show.
You want to help me with this?
Afternoons from 3 to 6 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ambassador Francis Rooney. He is a former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, the Vatican. He served there from mid-2005 to 2008 under President George W. Bush. He is currently back in the private sector. He is the CEO of Rooney Holdings, serves on a number of other boards. He has in the past been an international president of an organization I admire greatly, the international arm of the Young Presidents Organization. And he is the author, importantly, of a new book entitled The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I have some background in this, though mostly at second and third hand, but I was a great admirer of the role played by John Paul, the former Pope, during a critical moment in the Cold War, when he joined forces with my old boss Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, really, to help bring down the Soviet Union. There's no question, to my way of thinking at least, that this was a force for good, as you put it, about the Vatican. Talk a little bit about the Vatican in more recent times, particularly while you were serving there, the role that it has played, and do you think that it's of a piece with the kind of really catalytic effect that that it had in changing our world back at the high point of the Soviet Union's sort of beginning of its demise, I guess I should say?
Yeah, Frank, that's exactly why I wrote the book. That a lot of people, when I've spoke around, I've found that a lot of people have very little familiarity with the role that the Holy See's played in many important diplomatic junctures, including the one you just talked about, as well as more recently. And I think that now more than ever, with the kinds of problems we face in the world, the soft power of the Holy See offers great value to global diplomacy. That's my the thesis of the book. You know, when I was there, we worked with the Holy See to try to strengthen the Christian coalition in Lebanon, which, you know, the Holy See was uniquely positioned to do, to work with the Patriarch, who to maintain the tripartite coalition that had kept peace in Lebanon for many years and was threatened by the political rise of Hezbollah. Worked successfully there for a while, and, you know, as you know, Hariri the son was elected, and peace was maintained for a few more years until finally Hezbollah overran the whole program.
Yeah, that's a very interesting example of a larger problem that, of course, is afflicting not just the Middle East these days, but other parts of the world as well, as you know, Mr. Ambassador, and that is the assault on Christians, notably by Islamists, but not exclusively. Do you see the Holy See at the moment playing this sort of protective role, engaging on the behalf of these Christians, or is it less active in that score?
Yes, I think they are. I think you go back to Regensburg, you know, which George Weigel considered to be the most important papal pronouncement since John Paul's human rights address to the UN in 1995, you know, where the Pope could speak out more clearly than elected officials around the world against the menace of religion used as a excuse for violence and radical Islam. When Mrs. Bush came to Rome with me, and as we met with the Pope in 2006, he spoke of the spread of radicalism in Africa then, which has this last summer showed its head in Mali and Somalia and Niger and Nigeria. And so I think it's critically important that the Holy See continue to speak up. Just a few weeks ago, the Pope issued his probably his first diplomatic note, Pope Francis, about Syria, where he again called on a focus on the centrality of the person and for a broader concept of citizenship, which includes minorities and particularly Christians, and that Christians be included in any post Bashar peace discussions. And I think that's very important. And I hope other nations will pick up on that and say, yeah, that's a good idea. We've got to do that. The same way George Bush made sure that the Holy See was included in the 2006 Annapolis Peace Conference.
I'm very interested that you spoke of Regensburg. And, of course, you were serving as ambassador from our country to the Holy See at the time that speech was made. It was wildly controversial, even though what the Pope said then was – Pope Benedict at the time – was rather understated in some important ways. But he walked it back, I guess, is one of the things that I found troubling. He was under enormous pressure to do so, but he did rather recant, didn't he?
Well, he did a funny thing. He apologized that they misunderstood his message, but he never apologized for delivering it.
The message itself.
And you know, if you read Regensburg, it reads much more balanced than the couple of little sound bites that were extracted in the broadcast media.
Yeah, and promoted by the Islamists as right. A casus belli. Yeah.
And that in fact proves right there the absurd political correctness that we see in this country now and again, where people will bend over backwards to try to appease strong voices instead of confronting their right or wrong, and that's what the Pope did. Since he did it, you know, there have been several instances of strong interreligious discussion. 38 Muslim clerics signed a letter saying that it's time for that Islam has to find consonance between the modern world and the Quran. You know, there have been some positive things result from that. You know, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia came to see the Pope right after Regensburg.
It has had some interesting offshoots. My recollection is that some of the folks who've been associated with these interreligious dialogue things have actually been dissembling quite a bit about some of the tenets of their faith, including, you know, the Sharia edict for jihad, most especially. And I guess I want to just sort of draw you out as you look at the new Pope. And again, we're speaking with a distinguished author and former diplomat, Ambassador Francis Rooney, who has written The Global Vatican, an inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. But talk, if you would, a little bit as you see it today, Mr. Ambassador, the new Pope, Pope Francis, where does he come down on this kind of soft power being used to stand up to the strong voices, I guess, is to use some of your words? Do you see him, in fact, carrying on in this tradition of Regensburg and being a force for good at a time when not only Christians are under assault, but an awful lot of others from enemies of freedom and indeed religious freedom, most especially?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful, and I can point to two circumstances which give factual support to that hope. Is, first of all, the way he dealt with the Videla dictatorship in Argentina and then the last 12 years fighting the Kirchners show that he clearly has the mettle to tangle, as Pope Benedict did, against radical Islam, if need be. The other thing is he's appointed as Secretary of State, certainly one of, or if not the most capable of the new era of Vatican diplomats, Pietro Parolin. He could not have made a better appointment for someone to lead the diplomatic outreach and engagement.
And that is because, for those of us who are unfamiliar with this Secretary of State, he is an advocate on behalf of these fundamental principles of religious freedom?
He's a very experienced diplomat from the Pontifical Academy. He served in many posts. He attended the Annapolis Peace Conference, represented the Holy See there in 2006. And he recently has spent 3 years or so serving as the nuncio in Venezuela, which is a good way to earn your battle stripes.
Yes,
for sure.
Indeed. The Chavismo team is no friend of freedom, that's for sure.
I worked with him very closely when I was there, and he's just really knowledgeable about Islam, about Eastern Europe, about the risks of secularism, all these factors of Holy See diplomacy. He's schooled up quite well on and should be an effective advocate.
Well, this is encouraging indeed. We have to let you go, Ambassador Francis Rooney, author of The Global Vatican, an Inside Look at the Catholic Church, World Politics, and the Extraordinary Relationship Between the United States and the Holy See. I hope that relationship will prosper despite some of the political correctness that passes for sensible policy in this country as well, and I think is giving rise to more of these dangers around the world rather than less. Mr. Ambassador, I hope we'll be able to continue this conversation with you. Thank you very much. Congratulations on the new book.
We'd love to, and thank you, Frank.
We'll talk with you in the near future. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.